Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, it's always a pleasure to talk to him, is writer and historian Eric J. Dolan. And we're talking about his new book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, the epic history of America's most notorious pirates. Eric, welcome back. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
This is my favorite book by far.
Great.
This is a good one. And it's got an interesting focus because this is not a general book about pirates. What is it?
Well, it's a book that uses pirates to tell a tale of American history from the middle to late 1600s to the early 1700s. Pirates, you know, are romantic figures in history, but they also had a major impact on American history. And this is all news to me because I didn't know a lot about pirates before I started writing this book. And one of the most fascinating elements of the entire book was how important pirates were to the colonial economy.
I had no idea about this either. And your uncovering this research was really sort of fascinating to me because it ends up the colonies, and this is going to sound ludicrous, but in the movie The Wild One, where the biker gang comes into the town, and the town's really initially going, yeah, because they're going to spend a lot of money.
Yep.
And that sort of struck me as the colonists' attitude towards pirates, except it was even deeper.
Yeah, well, many of the pirates that were operating, especially the ones that were going to the Indian Ocean and attacking Mughal trading ships from India, they came from the colonies. They were the sons, the husbands of the people who lived in the colonies, and more importantly, they brought back to the colonies specie, coin, silver, gold, treasure, at a time when the colonies were strapped for this because of how they were treated by the mother country, sort of like a piggy bank.
So they brought a lot of money, and they spent a lot of money.
Yes. There is one case, one of the earliest pirates to come to the American colonies was in 1646, a guy named Thomas Crowell, who came to the Plymouth colony. And his crew of 80 lusty and rowdy men sort of ripped apart the town for a little while, but then they gave some of their booty to the poorer people in town, and they were viewed almost as a godsend by the local merchants and politicians.
It is like The Wild One with Marlon Brando.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, you know, if somebody is an outlaw, if they're an outlaw that enriches you, you view them quite differently than if they're an outlaw that attacks you.
And this brought up all sorts of complex political things that went on. And that's the other thing that I got out of. I mean, there's the great pirate stories are here, of course. Right. But this is a complex political situation that's going on between Britain, the colonies, and Britain and the British East India Company, too. And the pirates are in the middle of it.
Right. Well, the mother country was very upset about the colonists' embrace of pirates. But it really got agitated when the pirates started attacking the cash cow for England, which was the British East India Company, which was bringing back tea, china, opium, all sorts of goods from the Far East. And as soon as the pirates, like Henry Avery and Captain Kidd, who ultimately turned to become a pirate, went into the Indian Ocean and started attacking the economic lifeline of much of the British economy, that's when Parliament and the Crown clamped down on pirates in America.
Well, it's interesting, and we need to talk about this right away, and you make this differentiation early in the book. The difference between a pirate and a privateer.
Right. A privateer is a ship that gets a letter of marque from a government to attack the government's enemies during time of war. So it's often called licensed piracy. It's a way of sort of expanding the strength of the navy of the country when it's engaged in a war with another country. Pirates, on the other hand, sometimes they do have letters of marque that are false, but pirates are more acting on their own. They're the equivalent of land-based thieves at sea.
It seems that also in some of the stories, they started out as privateers and then just went, yeah, let's just do everybody.
Yeah. Well, when you're a privateer and you're attacking ships, you get to keep a percentage of the wealth that's on that ship. So some of those privateers did slowly merge into pure piracy because they thought, well, why do we need to share this money with the government or our owners? We can just take it for ourselves.
Well, let's start back at the beginning. And the reason there are privateers like Sir Francis Drake is that Britain's at war with Spain, and Spain is really taking gold out of the quote-unquote New World, like you would not believe. What are the sort of headquarters for gold in Spain in Central and South America?
Well, Spain had ruthlessly conquered the Aztec and Incan empires in the 1500s. And what they quickly realized was that there was a lot of gold and silver in South and Central America. And they started transporting that back to Spain in these treasure ships. And this was not hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is millions and perhaps billions of dollars equivalent to today. And a lot of other European powers looked at Spain's grab of land in Central and South America and also their commandeering of all this treasure, and they were incredibly jealous. So they often, the rulers often got privateers such as Sir Francis Drake, who was actually really a pirate because they weren't officially at war with Spain at the time. But essentially they sent out, military ships were sent out to attack these treasure fleets as they made their way not only from Mexico to the Philippines, but also from Central America and South America back to Spain. And this became a lucrative source of income for many of the other countries who had been muscled out of the treasure of Central and South America by the Spaniards.
And at this point, I have to ask you this, and I'm so glad you put all this in the book. What's a doubloon?
A doubloon is just a gold piece, escudo, from South America.
It's a two escudo.
Yeah. Two
so escudo. It's double.
Yeah.
It's double a doubloon, and pieces of eight. There really were pieces of eight.
Yeah, they were. It's a Spanish silver dollar. It's an 8 real coin, and sometimes they were broken into pieces to serve sort of as change, and that's why they were called pieces of eight.
Now, where did most of the pirates operate out of in sort of the North American, South American area?
Well, it depends what time you're talking about. In the mid-1600s, the buccaneers, like Henry Morgan, they were operating out of Jamaica, and that was the main port during much of the 1600s. And then once they went to the Indian Ocean and started attacking Mughal ships, then the main base of operations was the Isle of St. Marie, which was off of Madagascar. And then later on, after the Spanish War, the War of Spanish Succession, and this is the time when most people think of pirates, you know, when Blackbeard was around, the main base of operations was in Nassau in the Bahamas. Also, earlier, in the late 1600s, a number of pirates would come back to colonial ports where they drop off their booty, and many of them would settle there, and many of the pirate ships would then ultimately leave from ports like Newport and Charleston and New York.
Well, it was amazing to read. Like they would capture silver from this from these Spanish ships, and they would bring them to Boston because Boston had one of the first mints in the New World.
Right. If you have Spanish silver dollars, which was the main currency in the colonies for many, many years, but if you wanted to hide your treasure, you wanted to transform it into something else. And you could either mint it into a local currency, or silversmiths, which were a very important element of local commerce in the colonies, would take gold and silver from the pirates and transform it into other objects. And since the value of the coins was basically the value of the precious metals, if you had 100 pieces of eight turned into a bowl or a couple of forks, it still had value. And at a later point, you could melt down those forks and bowls and transform them into ready currency.
Now, there's so much weird information about pirates, and you address this at end in this book. It's really difficult to tell fact from fiction. I mean, and you do a great job of it. You really take the conservative route in this. But there's this book, A General History of the Pirates by Captain Charles Johnson.
Right.
Which is, I think, most of the stories we hear about pirates come from that, but it's a totally unreliable source.
Well, I wouldn't say it's totally unreliable. He, whoever Charles Johnson was, and for many years people thought he was Daniel Defoe, using a pseudonym, which doesn't appear to be the case, but whoever he was, he used a lot of contemporary accounts. There were newspapers, there were a lot of trial proceedings. So a lot of what's in Charles Johnson's book, which is this huge volume of material, is accurate and can be corroborated by other contemporary sources. However, it's also very clear that he took massive literary liberties when it suited the narrative arc of his story. And so you have to be careful using Charles Johnson. But it is such a font of information about the pirates of the Golden Age that you essentially can't write a book about piracy of this era without, to some extent, relying a little bit on Charles Johnson, but doing it judiciously.
When did that book come out?
1724. It was originally published, but it had a number of subsequent editions going up to the early 1730s.
So it was a bestseller.
Oh, yeah. It was definitely a bestseller at the time. I wasn't able to find any numbers on how many books were sold, but it's mentioned an awful lot, and it has been used and is still in print in one form or another.
My God.
Today.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, is writer, historian, Eric J. Dolan. And we're talking about his new book. You know you're going to have to read this. Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. Oh, God, you just by the title, you know you have to read it. I want to talk to you about some general things about pirates, and you have a nice section on that in the book. I was amazed how they got around. I mean, they would go from the Caribbean up to Maine, back again. They would go over to the Indian Ocean. What are they sailing that they're able to make these kinds of trips at that time of the history?
Well, they're sailing the ships that merchantmen use, everything from sloops to brigs to schooners to snows. I mean, there's all variety of shipping that's being used during this era to take goods and people up and down the coast and across the ocean. And what these mariners achieved, not just pirates, but mariners in general, was often really incredible. They had to sail through rough weather. They didn't have the benefit of forecasts to tell them when rough weather was going to come upon them. And the pirates, almost all of the pirates, came from the marine world. It would be sort of hard to be thrown onto a pirate ship or a ship of any type and expect to be able to sail it if you had no maritime experience. So they were drawn from the ranks of sailors largely, and they would take ships as they could, and if they found a better ship, they would trade their old ship for the better ship, and they'd keep trading up until they got a larger and larger and faster ship. But there was a limit to their ambitions. They didn't want too large of a ship, because one of the things pirates had to do was be nimble and escape pursuers such as the military. And one of the best ways to do that, especially in the Caribbean and even along the coast of America, was to be able to dart into bays and coves and the mouths of rivers.
Wow.
And if you were in a huge ship, it's easy to find you, and second, it's hard to elude attackers.
And you make no bones about the fact that everybody romanticizes pirates, but they were by and large a fairly rough crowd. And that's being circumspect. I mean, they were really often very violent.
Yes, they were often violent. But what was surprising to me is they were able to advertise the possibility of violence, imminent violence, as a means to avoid violence. In a sense, when a pirate ship came upon you, if you were a merchantman, you had heard the reputations about how violent these pirates could be, and that would lessen your zeal for defending your ship. So many times, pirates were able to overcome the ships they were attacking without any effusion of blood whatsoever. However, most pirates, if there was opposition, if the ship they were attacking, fought back, they would fight. And then you have scenes of sometimes just bloody murder, you know, blood washing the decks. And some pirates were sort of sadistic, too. Most of them, they would rather not fight. They'd rather win without fighting, because to fight was to put themselves in jeopardy,
right,
was also to put the ship they were attacking in jeopardy, and potentially the valuable cargo that might be in the hold.
Well, one of the things you mentioned about the cargo and their plunder, I have to use that word,
plunder,
is it wasn't just the gold that they were taking. They were taking sort of everyday goods, too.
Absolutely. And this became an increasingly common phenomenon as the Golden Age wore on, because the pirates went from being welcome in a number of ports to being attacked wherever they went. So essentially, they had to stay at sea for longer and longer times, and they didn't have the opportunity to go into port and stock up on the things that they needed to survive. So in addition to treasure, which is what they always hoped to find on one of their victims, they also wanted hogsheads of, you know, meat and bread and rum and wine and clothes, anything that they could use to sustain them as this floating society as
Wow.
they went from place to place looking to find new victims.
There's several scenes in your book of like them coming across huge hogsheads of wine. And naturally, the whole crew gets incredibly, you know, drunk, which
yes.
never ends well.
it's not good. That is one of the stereotypes of pirates that is 100% true. There was a lot. I mean, you know, society at large at this time was awash in liquor.
That's right.
People were drinking
right.
beer when they got up in the morning, and I mean, it was a major thing for people on land as well as on sea, and sailors already had a reputation of being heavy drinkers, but these pirates, sort of outcasts from society, whenever they found a victim whose hold had hundreds if not thousands of gallons of tasty Madeira wine or rum or some other liquor, yeah, they partook, and sometimes they drank so much they drank themselves into oblivion, which caused problems for a few of them who were attacked by naval ships at the very time that they were nursing a hangover.
Now, given all this, one of the strangest things to read in your book is that they adopted a sort of democratic procedures for running the ship.
Right.
It was called the Common Council.
Yeah, the Common Council, the Pirate Code, the articles that they all signed when they became pirates. Essentially, think about it this way. The pirates, they were democratic in the sense that they voted on who would be the captain and who would be the quartermaster, which is sort of like the enforcer. They voted on where they would go to find victims, which ships they would attack, and the distribution of the booty was fairly even. So, yes, it does smack of democratic ideals, but it's a mistake to interpret that as pirates being political philosophers who are employing democracy because it was an ideology that they agreed with. That wasn't the case at all. They were this floating society, and they needed to establish rules that they could live by. Now, many of them had mutinied when they became pirates. Many of them had been abused in the merchant
right,
or naval
right.
service by captains. So they didn't want to recreate that kind of environment on their pirate ship. They didn't want to give too much power to one man. And that's why the pirate captain was elected, and he could be removed by a vote of the Common Council. And also distributing goods in a fairly equitable manner was another way to keep inherently rowdy pirates in line. Just imagine, these people are putting their lives on the line. They're outcasts of society. This is especially in the 1700s. And then you tell them that certain people on board are going to get five times as much as the other people on board, and it just doesn't work. So it's a mistake for people to view their democratic tendencies as a political statement, but it is not a mistake to view it as a logical and sensible way to construct a floating society so that some measure of calm can be maintained.
We got to talk about the pirate flag. Now, it's interesting, and you, and this comes up in a lot of the stories, a lot of the histories that you talk about in this book. They would often fly another country's flag to sort of sneak up on a ship.
Yeah, it's deception. I mean, they weren't the only ones that did it. During times of war, ships of one country often had multiple flags on board. And the idea is to lull your enemy or your victim into a false sense of confidence that, hey, this is not somebody coming to attack me. This might be one of my fellow countrymen. So pirates were very adept at doing this, and they usually had multiple flags on board. And if they were chasing a French ship, they would raise a French flag. If they were chasing an English ship, they would raise, you know, the Union Jack. So it was a very smart way to go about it, because you're at sea. You can't just put your foot on the gas pedal and speed up. You've got to live with the wind that you're given, and sometimes it's very hard to catch up to another ship quickly, especially if you're equally matched. But if you can get them in any way to slow down and put down their guard so that you can get within distance of being able to fire a broadside, and then you can raise your pirate flag and tell the people who were formerly, you know, unconcerned that, hey, we're pirates. If you don't surrender right now, we are going to attack. So it was a very smart strategy.
But were there really Jolly Rogers? Were there really black flags that some of them hoisted?
Yes, there absolutely were. One of the problems for historians, though, is that not many of them are well described in contemporary accounts, and not a single pirate flag from the Golden Age has survived. There is a pirate flag that I show in the book.
Right, right.
That's from the early, you know, late 1700s, maybe early 1800s, that's in a Finnish museum that does show a skull and crossbones. But we know for a fact that these flags were flown, because a lot of contemporary newspaper accounts and trial accounts talk about the Jolly Roger. They even use that word, and they talk about the pirate flag. But you have to be careful, because if you get a modern book on piracy, like there's a great book, the Time Life book on pirates.
Oh, I have that.
That's got a huge two-page spread of all these different pirate flags. Well, for some of them, yes, we have descriptions that would lead us to believe this is what that pirate's flag looked like. But for many of them, they're more emanations of the imagination of the graphic artist at the time than they were or are a reflection of what actually transpired in history. So you just have to be careful saying this was, you know, Blackbeard's flag, this was Edward Lowe's flag. You know, in some cases you can prove it by contemporary accounts. In other cases, you have to let your imagination run free.
Now, almost all the pirates were male, but there is that great case of Anne Bonny and Mary Read. And Anne Bonny's become really famous because of the Star series Black Sails. She was like this major figure in that. And there were those two women definitely were pirates. They were with what, Charles Rackham?
Yes, they were. But what's ironic, you mentioned the TV show and how central of a character she is. If you look at what actual evidence in history her reputation is based on, it could fill less than a page, perhaps. There's very, very little we know about these two women other than some of the information that came through in the trial of Rackham and the other pirates in Nassau, or Port Royal. So it's fascinating to me. I mean, people love these stories because a woman pirate, it engages your attention immediately. And in some cases, there are entire articles or books that have been written about these two women. And that's quite a feat, given how little we actually know about them.
What I love is how they got off, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, during the trial, they were found guilty and they were going to be hanged. But then they did what was termed at the time pleading their bellies. They were both pregnant. And the court gave them dispensation, and they weren't to be sent to be hanged. But then the history sort of goes silent. We know that one of them died, and the other one, we're not really sure what happened, but neither of them were hung or hanged.
Right. We're just not sure what happened to Anne. Didn't she and there's all sorts of wild rumors about that she like went to the colonies, that she ended up being this woman who owned a bar. I mean, all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah. And they're fun to think about. I doubt that they're real. It's just like sightings of Elvis and other mythologies that have arisen over the years. They get bigger with the retelling. I mean, it's like Charles, it's like, Blackbeard, probably one of the most pirates of all. There's a lot of mythology around him. One of them is something that was spawned by the Captain Charles Johnson that we spoke about before. He claimed that Blackbeard had 14 wives at one point, and that he used to prostitute some of his wives to his men. Well, there's no evidence that he was ever married, or let alone had one wife, and the prostitution part was probably added by Charles Johnson to include a salacious element to his narrative that would help sell books and sort of feed into the common reputation of pirates as these miscreants, which they were to some extent. But mythology can often overwhelm facts. And if a lie or a mistruth is repeated long enough in enough books, it starts to become accepted as real. And it's sometimes tough to cut through all the baloney.
We've only scratched the surface of this book, and we're out of time because there's all the stories, and a lot of them don't end well for the pirates.
Yes.
My returning guest tonight, you're going to have to read the book to find that out. My returning guest tonight is writer, historian Eric J. Dolan. And we're talking about his new book. You just hear the title and you know you want to read this. Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. Eric, it's been a pleasure. Great book.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.